or we've got some other instrumentation might have been shot out or damaged by flak. Well, we need special people to come in. If something, if you got damage in the turret, we've got to get turret people. We have all these specialized people at our disposal, but I'd have to make an assessment of the airplane and then tell my boss to get me these people down here. And all the crew chiefs are doing that. So there's an immediate demand for all this talent that we have. And then the things that are strictly mechanical, you know, that would come to me and my crew of two people. You know, maybe we've got flak damage on an engine. We have to change the engine. Or any of the mechanical working parts of the airplane. That's where we make an assessment. Is there any way we can possibly get this ship operational again for a mission tomorrow? Now, the ship probably come back at 4:30 in the afternoon or something like that. And there might be 20 hours of work to get it ready again. Well, 20 hours of work, that wouldn't be enough time to get ready to go off at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning again. You know, so you'd have to make an assessment. Can you possibly get this ship ready for operation tomorrow? And you say, not with what we have. You know, if you can get me two more guys, you know, from some ship, some crew that isn't going to be busy. Maybe an airplane got shot down. So there's a ground crew waiting for their airplane didn't come back. They've got nothing to do. So maybe, you know, if you need two more guys, they'd bring some of that crew down to help you work and get your ship down. And so we would work however long it took to get the ship operation. And we had, you know, we'll work late into the night, the next morning if necessary, to a point where when they served meals at the mess hall at midnight, called it midnight mess, there might be 600 guys out there eating dinner at midnight, or eating a meal, because they probably still haven't got their airplanes ready to go the next morning. So some of these jobs just take time. They take hours, you know, and hours. And even as proficient as we got, you still, something has to be physically possible to be able to complete. And there's this tremendous sense of getting it ready as quickly as possible. And it's only at the last resort would you want to tell anybody or have to tell anybody that you can't have it ready by tomorrow morning. And so while we might have been lazing around for 8 hours all day long waiting for the ships to come back, that's when to work again, because now you might be working until 3 o'clock in the morning. And then fall into your cot, sleep for an hour and a half, and then it's time to get up and run up the engines and make sure everything's ready to go again. And so the last thing you do, when you finished everything, you say to yourself, the ship is ready, you go to bed, but then you have to get up in the morning and start all over again and run up the engines and look things over. And when the air crew comes out, you can walk up to the pilot and say, she's ready to go, and mean it. So it's a lot of hard work, you know, and I don't know why, even in 1942, we didn't have electric screwdrivers and air drills and things like that, but we did all that stuff by hand, you know. And if you come back with flak damage in the gasoline tank, you know, they're huge tanks that might have 600 screws in them to hold a panel up to keep the gasoline tank in place. Do all that by hand, you know, and after you get through, well, you just have blisters all over your hands. Yeah, that's when the work begins, when the crews come back and the airplanes are back, and if there's battle damage, gotta fix it and do anything to get it going. And if you're lucky, there's no damage, you know, so you don't have to do much more except look it over and gas it up, check all the fluid levels, and maybe go to a movie that night, or go to the beer hall, you know, or visit with friends or something like that. And you never quite knew what to expect. And sometimes it would be good, sometimes it would be bad, but that's what happened. That's what we did.
Right. That's very interesting. This is just kind of on the lighter side now. How did you keep in touch with your family?
I was a pretty good writer. I won't say that. And even at this day, I write 8 to 10 letters a week. A week. Well, I buy my stationery 1,000 sheets at a time. But then I'd say I probably wrote maybe once or twice a week. I'd write a letter. I guess they were little V-mails. You know, they'd get microfilmed, I think.
Oh.
I'm not sure about that. But I would write. There was no phone communication.
Right.
Or
cell phones, huh?
No cell phones.
Yeah.
No,
or emails. What was the food like?
It was more than adequate. I first of all, because of my background, and I was taught early on, don't complain about food. A rule in our house, my father had told us once or twice, never more than that. He said, I don't care if you don't clean your plate. He says, but if you don't clean up your plate, stay out of the kitchen and stay out of the pantry. You're going to get a licking if you do go in there. Well, we got the message, you know, clean your plate. If you take it, eat it. So, and it was always a matter, and many times spoken in the spirit of levity, but there was some substance to the remark to eat it and be darn glad you've got it. So first of all, I wasn't a finicky eater. I liked virtually everything. And the guys used to kid me because I love powdered eggs, and I still like scrambled eggs, you know, and I buy those, right to this day, I buy those egg substitutes, and I make omelets and powdered eggs and then put anything in them, you know. Well, anyway, I liked the food. It was more than adequate. We were fortunate, you know, and sure, you're eating off of a tin tray, but it's the Army, you know, and that's what it was, so. The short answer to your question, I liked it well.
That's good to hear. Did you have plenty of supplies?
Pardon?
Did you have plenty of supplies? When you needed supplies, were they there? Were they available?
Absolutely. You know, I think the United States and our federal government, they do a lot of dumb things, but they do a lot of things very well. When it comes to organization and logistics, I don't think anybody comes close to the United States. And we are good at organization and logistics. Supplies is something that we're good at. And yes, we had everything we needed. I can't think of anything that we wished we had. I mentioned a moment ago, I wish we'd had electric drills or something like that to make our
but
work.
Nobody else had those.
Nobody
either.
Else had them either, no.
Right.
The supplies were good. As a matter of fact, when I was in mechanic school, they taught us how to disassemble carburetors and rebuild them, and taught us how to disassemble magnetos and rebuild them. And when we got into combat, we couldn't take that much time to rebuild a carburetor. It was remove and replace. So there was a marvelous flow of everything we needed for that kind of mechanicking. We didn't rebuild anything. They had special teams that would do that. You know, if you got a carburetor that wasn't running right, while I was trained to fix a carburetor, they didn't have time to take a carburetor apart take the carburetor off and send it into the sub depot. You know, just they got people that worked on carburetors all day long. They're rebuilding carburetors, but on the lines, you got to get the plane back ready, operational, and so you can go on another mission tomorrow. It's just like in today, an analogous situation is when there's a derailment in a train. They want that line open. They don't care what it costs. You know, they get, if you need two D8 Caterpillars, get them. You know, get the line repaired so we can move traffic back and forth. Well, that's the way it was. If we had a flak hole in a cylinder on an engine, well, I could change a cylinder maybe in about 8 hours, but I could change the whole engine in 2 hours. And so, if we get flak hole in a cylinder, wouldn't think of working on a cylinder. That was hard work. That was difficult to do. Wouldn't take 8 hours, but it might take four or five hours. Where you get people that know what they're doing, we could take the whole engine off in 2 hours and get it back running again. So it was all remove and replace, because we had all this constant flow of material that you talk about. There was a carburetor there, there was a magneto there, there was this there, there was that there. And if we didn't have that, we'd rob it off of an airplane that couldn't go on a mission tomorrow. One that was out of operation, they had so much damage on it that they couldn't possibly, we'd go and borrow something off of that other airplane. And then, you know, got time to fix that, you know, got 2 days to get that airplane back together again, but got to get yours back right now.
That's very interesting. Was there anything special you did for good luck?
No, I'm not a superstitious person.
That wasn't your thing, huh?
No.
And how did people entertain themselves? Now, you mentioned a few things about going into London.
Entertaining on the base. Some of the guys would play softball during the day when the planes were gone, you know, killing time. That's what we're doing, killing time. And many times we'd be sleeping, you know, because we'd been up all night long. I'm going to say half of the time we've been up until midnight or later getting your ship ready. So you fall in bed for a couple hours, and then you got to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and run up the engines, and then another mission, you know, and pretty soon they're out there, everybody's around the airplane, their bombs are loaded, and oxygen people come around, the turret people come around, they make last-minute checks on it, the air crew comes out, and then they take off, and then you go and eat, and then you go back to bed. So a lot of times when the ships are gone, that's when we'd be sleeping. But entertainment, if you had free time in the evening after a mission, there was always a beer hall there. The beer was free. There was always a movie every night. Sometimes there were British movies that weren't very good, but they were there. They had something equivalent to a reading room or a library or something if you did that. I can't remember ever going in there, but I go to the movies at the beer hall. And we had a lot of rabbits on the base. We'd go out and catch rabbits and maybe cook up some rabbits and get some beer, and we could go up to the beer hall, you know, and get a couple of gallons of beer and take it back out to the line and cook up, have
That's
a
great.
Rabbit feed, you know.
That's great.
Or maybe just visit your buddies.
Sure. Do you remember anything humorous or any pranks you pulled on each other? Or
I don't remember offhand. I don't remember offhand any special prank. I'm sure we did that. One of the things that we did also to entertain ourselves, which invariably wound up in a humorous mode, was we all had bicycles to get around, to get from the line back up to the mess hall, to get to, you know, it's like a 3/4 of a mile to the mess hall from where the airplanes were at. We lived with the airplanes. We had tents. I'll show you some pictures later on. We had tents and shacks and so on down on the line by airplanes. And the mess hall 3/4 of a mile away, and the orderly room the office, if you will, another quarter of a mile, so we had bicycles to get around. And if your airplane came back and everything was in pretty good shape and some of your buddies were in the same situation, well, we'd say, well, what do you say we cycle over to this little village, you know, and go to the pub there. And the pub's going to be open for 2 hours from 6:30 to 8:30 or 7 to 9. Well, that's not long to drink. And so we would always order half pint. And the idea being that if you get a little half pint of ale and somebody says bottoms up, well, you could drink a half pint. But if you had a whole pint, you couldn't do that. So it was a lot of rapid drinking. And of course, the 2 hours, if you have rapid drinking, well, you can get pretty blitzed, you know, and then you have to ride those bicycles back home. Yeah, that was funny because a lot of bicycles got wrecked one way or another, and incidentally, because there were so many bicycles and so many of them getting wrecked, if you wreck your bicycle, why, there's your bicycle, now what are you going to do? Because there was a lot of bicycles being stolen. And maybe, you know, if you wreck your bicycle, it depended what you broke, well, you'd steal a bicycle somewhere and take the fork off or the wheel off or whatever you needed to fix your own bicycle. And it got so bad that they had to assign an MP. Was on just, his whole duty was just to track down bicycle thieves, you know. So that was, you know, kind of funny, but it was true. You know, we had good times at the pubs and around town. Well, first we were out in the country. I shouldn't say around town. We were out in the country. And invariably, when we go to town or go to one of these little pubs, this little village intersection maybe, get to know some of the people. You know, you see them there, the same old codgers would be there, sitting there every night, having their glass of ale. And of course, Americans always had money, you know, so and they were very liberal about buying drinks. And so some of the British people, some of the old guys hanging around there, the British people, they could go there and stay there all night long and never spend a sixpence, you know.
That's great. What did you think of the officers and your fellow soldiers?
The officers' relationship with the officers?
Yeah, what did you think of them?
Well, I'd have to say to begin with, the Air Force has always historically been a little more lenient, I think, than many of the other branches about military protocol. And particularly, there was an understanding that down on the line, by the airplane, on the airfield, that's our working area. We don't salute officers in the working area. If you're up around the orderly room, a different story, you know. But we were very friendly with our crews, except, as I told you before, my later crews, I didn't engender a close relationship with them. I didn't want it. I just made it clear that I was doing the best job I could do, and I wasn't standoffish, but at the same time I was. I didn't want to be that way, but I didn't get overly friendly with them. But there were exceptions to that, of course. Some people, you just naturally come together very easily. And fun to spend time with the air crews, but the truth of the matter is, they live pretty much in their world, and we live pretty much in our world. Once in a great while, if we had friends, and we were air crew friends that we wanted to spend time with, and they were free as we were, maybe they came back from a mission, and it was not a very bad mission, you know, and we might say, hey, we've got a rabbit tooth going on, why don't you come on down? We didn't do that often, but once in a while we'd bring in a pilot or a gunner or something like that, just because we got along well with them. But for the most part, they lived together in up in the living in Quonset huts. We lived the ground crews lived out with the airplanes in tents. And I want to talk a little bit about that a little later on. My relationship with them was always cordial, you know, and we'd visit with them, but you got to remember, most of the time we'd see them would be before a mission or after a mission. Well, before the mission, they're nervous and they're worried a lot of times. They are, you know, it wasn't a time to be light and funny. You know, you're just pleasant. You know, and then, how you doing, something like that, you know, but you never crack jokes with them because some of these guys are, some of them, I've seen guys that be so nervous they go out behind the airplane and throw up, you know. It was always pleasant, and my closest friend was a pilot that I still visit with. I just wrote him a 4-page letter about 4 days ago. He was a little guy, he was a young guy, he was 21 years old, but he was all business. And it seemed like he shouldn't have been. At that age, he shouldn't have been that serious. But later on, you know, he and I had become very close friends. He told me, "Don," he said, "I realized that as the commander of that airplane, what I did, had a bearing on what was going to happen to those other 9 guys." He says, "In a sense, all of us were in your hands. Here I'm a 19-year-old kid." He says, "All of us were in your hands. You tell us if everything is okay on this airplane. And we trusted you." And he says, "These guys trust me. And I'm the commander. I'm 21 years old." And so he was all business. You know, and I only saw that side of him during the war. After the war, why he was like anybody else. He liked to laugh and joke, but I don't think I ever saw him laugh over in England because he was just serious about his work. Our relationship was good, but a lot of times not close. For the most part, the only time we saw them was before a mission, and they had compunctions about things, and after the mission, when they're used up, you know, maybe they've been 9 hour, 9.5 hour flight, maybe come back with maybe 2 engines run out of gasoline when they land, you know, and it's that tight. And I'll show you some of my airplanes a lot of harrowing experiences for them, you know. So when they come back, they didn't want to visit with anybody. They didn't have time. First of all, they're getting gathered up to be interrogated about what happened, you know. So not like we did any socializing with them. Once in a rare while, we'd invite one of them up out to the line. And most of the time, you know, either we're busy or they're busy or we got days off or they got days off. As rarely as that came, maybe 2 or 3 weeks we'd get time off, go to London or do something. But we didn't.
Did you keep a diary?
Pardon?
Did you keep a diary?
No. I wish I had. Even the photographs that I've got in that book, I never had a camera. To me, to this day, I wonder, how did I get all these pictures, you know? Somebody must have given them to me. No, I should have kept a diary. But I'm an 18-year-old, 19-year-old kid, you know. And I wasn't thinking right.
Right.
Some guys obviously did, and they wrote books, you know.
Do you know where you were when you heard about the news of the war being over? Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Do you care to share about that, where you were?
I was over there for both VE Day and VJ Day. On VE Day, I'm sure I went to London shortly after it was announced. Don't know if I went on schedule or whether it was pretty much everybody could take off or what. I don't recall those particulars, but I went to London, and it was just you know. Happy time.
Right.
Yeah, for everybody.
That's
you know. Right. As a matter of fact, I had one BE day. I didn't have any money, and I had an opportunity to go to town with my friends. And towards the end of the war, well, I'm getting mixed up a little bit now, VJ Day. Oh, VED, I just went to London, and it was just party time for 2 days, and then come back. But then on between then and VJ Day, I am getting confused now. Towards the end of the war in Europe, before VE Day, the troops were moving in real fast, the ground troops. They're making tremendous inroads into Germany, and they needed more people. And they put out a call to any resource where they thought they might have some soldiers. And even they called out people from the Air Corps. So some of the people, oddballs, guys that got in trouble, you know, the commander got a directive that says we need 50 guys from your organization, well, who's he going to take? You know, the ones that he can best afford to get along without. And these would be the oddballs, the guys that have been in trouble, and so on. Well, there was an exodus of some of these people to go over to the mainland and serve in the infantry. Well, we had a system at that time where you could bag up your laundry and send it in. And you really needed about 3 bags. You had to have one going to the laundry, and one there, and then one coming back. And maybe you needed 4 bags of laundry, because it took about a week or so to get anything done. And so there was everybody was sending in laundry. And now we're shipping a bunch of people out on short notice. They're gone. But the laundry bags are coming in, you know. So pretty soon there's a stack of laundry bags in the supply house. A huge mound of laundry bags full of clean laundry. VE Day came along. I had some time off, and I didn't have any money. And so I went in and put about 5 of these laundry bags in a big sack, and took it to London and on a train. And then I took it down to Piccadilly Circus, and there's a flea market down there. And I sold them, and that was just like money to me. And so anyway, VJ Day came along, and it was much the same thing again. A lot of celebration, and as it turned out, at that time there was talk about our group being sent over to England. Over to Europe on occupation duty. And then that was changed. My group was going to be sent over to occupation duty, but they were also starting to send back to the United States those soldiers who had accrued a certain number of points. Points being based on months of service overseas, and citations, or medals, if you will. And the criterion was if you had 85 points or more, you would be expedited back to the States. As it turned out, then I had 93 points, so I was one of those who was dispatched. Toward home being I was transferred to another bomb group that was going to go back to the States, because my bomb group was going to go over to occupation duty over in Germany. I get to the other bomb group, I was there for about a month, if that long, and then they decided to send that bomb group to occupation duty in Europe too. So then they transferred me to a fighter group, which was going back to the States. And I got there, and the next thing I know, I was transferred out of that into a marshalling group up in northern England. And from there, I was sent down to Southampton and got on a victory ship and came back on the ship. So it was a kind of an arduous, circuitous way to get back home, but I got home early, myself and a few other guys who had accrued this magic number and then some. And as it turned out, in the final analysis, they didn't send my original bomb group over to the continent. They came back to the States, and I probably beat them home by a couple of weeks, but I wish that I could have come back with my own bomb group, because I came back with a bunch of strangers, and I'd rather been with my friends.
That was my next question. You answered it. How did you get home?
Oh, I came back on a victory ship.
There you go.
That was on the tail end of a shakedown cruise. It was a brand new ship. It had been over, went over somewhere, I don't know where, but now it stopped in England and took us back to Camp Shanks, New York. That was an 8-day trip. What was nice about that is that it had marvelous food. We got milk and ice cream and steaks and beautiful food, where when we went over into Queen Elizabeth, we had British food and it was terrible. Only 18 meals, though, I told you about that.
What was the first thing you did when you got home?
Home, you mean like my home or in
your
the state?
Your home in Minnesota, in St. Paul.
I went down, I got home and my dad asked me, what are you going to do? And I said, well, they've got this thing called GI Bill, where you can go to college free. And I think I'll look into that. And he said, fine. He said, as long as you're going to school, you don't have to worry about something to eat or a place to sleep. He said, if you quit school, I want the boarding room in next week. And back to the whatever I had, 50% went to the house. I had a saver for it, and I could stand before it. And he didn't get into the details, but he says, I want the boarding room in next week. And I said, well, thanks, you know. I didn't have any idea of going to school and quitting. But I went down. One of the first things I did was go down to see the guy in the Veterans Administration and said, tell me about this GI Bill in college. He said, do you want to go to college? And I said, yes, I do. And he said, well, University of Minnesota started already. I got out in October. He said they had started their fall quarter. The university has started, McAllister has started, this has started, this has started. He says, they're all started except one, the Catholic College, College of St. Thomas. They were delayed because they had a naval D-12 program where they were training sailors for some function. And he said, I could get you in there, he says, but this is like on a Tuesday or Wednesday or something like that. And he says, you have to start Monday. So about 5 days after I was home, I was in college. Specifically what I did when I got home, I just languished at home with my parents, you know, getting reacquainted with them. And I had one of my dearest friends, in turn, he was my very best friend. He just died a couple of years ago. He was, he got out about a day before me or something like that. So he and I, we got together quickly and I went downtown to see how much beer we could drink and stuff like that. But the short answer to your question is that other than just getting reacquainted with my parents and my brother and relatives, I found myself in school 5 days after I got out of service. I went for a year and a half, and I quit, went on to Belmont, California, and I worked in a filling station out on Sunset Strip for a year. And then my buddies and I were on our way to Alaska, and our car broke down in Washington State. And we wound up picking fruit, apples, peaches, and pears. And then we learned that there wasn't any jobs up in Alaska, and because the war was over, and things were changing up there. And so we picked apples. We didn't continue to try to get to Alaska. We stopped and we picked apples for about, I don't know, 2 or 3 months, something like that, over there. And one day, when I was taking a break, I wasn't even taking a break, because when we were picking, my philosophy was, if you're out here, pick. Don't daydream. You're up on the ladder, pick, make money. And so I used to time myself, and my quota was I wanted to have 5 boxes of apples every 15 minutes. In other words, I allow myself 3 minutes per box to get a box of apples. And if in one period I didn't, maybe only had 4.5 boxes in that period, in 15 minutes, then the next 15 minutes I'd go really fast and get that half a box back, you know, to stay on quota. So we're very serious about picking. And it would be rare that we would daydream. But this one day I was daydreaming, and I was thinking along this line. I said, well, let's see, Don, what do you know how to do? You know how to skin cattle. You don't want to do that anymore. You know how to work on airplanes. You don't want to do that anymore. And when I was out the West Coast, like I said, I was working at a filling station out in L.A., out on Sunset Strip, I said, you know how to pump gasoline and lube cars, you don't want to do that anymore. And I said, I don't think you want any of those avocations for a lifetime pursuit. I think you better smarten up and go back to school. And I said, that's what I did. I went back. Now, after being off for a year, I went back and picked up my schooling.
And the GI Bill picked all that up for you.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
What was the biggest impact that the war had on you?
Biggest impact.
Do you think there was something you can put your finger on there?
Well, I suppose, I don't know how much of this is natural and how much of it is due to the war, but there was a dramatic change, of course. When I went in, I was, like I said, like an 18-year-old kid, and hadn't been anywhere. So I had my eyes opened, as many of the people that were in the service. It was a new experience for them. And it was a very accelerated growing up process. I suppose there is a natural growing up process, but when you get cast into a serious situation with a lot of people, there are going to be some bright people there, and there are going to be some responsibilities and a lot of lessons to be learned. And so the growing up process, that process of metamorphizing a boy into a man comes about very naturally and very quickly in that service. That was the most profound effect. It was a good effect on almost everybody in the service. Sure, there were some ne'er-do-wells and misfits, but they would have been ne'er-do-wells and misfits in heaven, you know, if they were to get there. That was the biggest effect. I think that I was experiencing that transition from a boy to a man. And I was still only 22 years old when I got out, you know. So, but that was a marvelous growing up period. You know, I saw so much in such a short time. Good, not all good. Bad, not all bad. You know, in relationships, you have a keen appreciation for people and their beliefs and you to learn how to get along with people, how to, when to stand up, when to sit down, when to shut up, and when to speak. And, that was the most profound effect. If there's other things I'll think about later on, but...
Would you do it again?
If I were young? Oh, indeed I would. I thought, if I were a young person, what would I want to do? The answer to that is, I would want to be in a city where they had a university, colleges, where I could go into military and pursue education in the military. That's what I would like to do. I would make it clear to my superiors, I want to get somewhere. I'm willing to do it, whatever it takes. I'm here because there's a university right alongside. I want to do this job, make you look good, and I want an opportunity to learn so that I can go too.
Would you encourage your grandchildren or your great-grandchildren to go into the service?
Yeah, but I'd like to send them with a sense of purpose. I wouldn't want them just to go to the military. I'd like to think that they would have some goal about getting into officers training school or going someplace where they could grow and get into the higher echelon. I just wouldn't want them to go and be a soldier. Not just to be a soldier or a sailor. I'd want them to either get prepared first or in conjunction with service.
Would you, have you gone to any movies, Hollywood's perception of what the war was like?
I liked The Longest Day because it had a spectacular cast, which is not terribly important to me, but the one that, Saving Private Ryan. I thought that was the best war picture that I've seen. I thought Tora, Tora, Tora was real good in the Pacific Ocean. Midway was well done. Incidentally, Midway had some actual footage from film taken by John Huston, I believe. So that film, while it's a Hollywood film, it utilized some actual films of a Japanese raid on out on the Midway. Saving Private Ryan, I'd say that was my favorite wartime movie, and I had this profound thought about Hollywood movies, and that is, I think the movie industry is doing a disservice to the young people. We watch TV now or any of the movies, and everybody's running around with automatic weapons and they're burp, burp, burp. They're shooting right and left, you know, bullets flying all over and people are falling over. It isn't like that in real life. You know, you get hit with a high-powered shell, it tears your whole damn shoulder off, you know, or blow half of your head off, something like that. It's not pretty. Once in a while, sure, you get a flesh wound. But when you see a movie we watch on TV, and they're probably firing 600 rounds in 30 seconds. And people just fall over, and they're like, oh, they're dead body. Well, wars aren't like that. People get hurt, and their guts spill out, you know, they get a knee blown off, and it's horrible, it's tragic. And some of that was in Saving Private Ryan. Some of those scenes were in the early part of the film were criticized because they were too graphic. Well, wars aren't nice.
They were real. More real. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think when Hollywood, you know, they show all of these automatic weapons, then people just fall over, you know, like, well, they're dead, you know, like that. A lot of times it is. I shouldn't talk about it because I don't know that much.
But that's good. You know, well, I'll just go ahead and turn this off.